aisle, and on the other side of the aisle, the threat of the constitutional or nuclear confrontation. This committee, with the leadership of Senator Leahy, has moved to a bipartisan approach. We had a prompt confirmation of the Attorney General. We reported out bills which have become legislation after being stalled for many years on bankruptcy reform and class action. We have confirmed contentious circuit court nominees. We have reported out unanimously the Patriot Act, and after very deliberate and complex hearings, reported out asbestos reform. So it has been quite a period for this committee. And now we face the biggest challenge of the year, perhaps the biggest challenge of the decade in this confirmation proceeding. I have reserved my own judgment on your nomination until the hearings are concluded. And it is my firm view that there ought not to be a political tilt to the confirmation of a Supreme Court justice. It oughtn't to be Republican or Democratic. We all have a responsibility to ask probing questions to determine qualification beyond academic and professional standing. These hearings, in my judgment, ought to be in substantive fact and in perception for all Americans, that all Americans can feel confident that the committee and the full Senate has done its job. There are no firmly established rules for questions and answers. I've expressed my personal view that it is not appropriate to ask a question about how the nominee would vote on a specific case, and I take that position because of the key importance of independence, that there ought not to be commitments or promises made by a nominee to secure confirmation. But senators have the right to ask whatever question they choose, and you, Judge Roberts, have the prerogative to answer the questions as you see fit, or not to answer them as you see fit. It has been my judgment, after participating in nine, this will be the 10th for me personally, that nominees answer about as many questions as they think they have to in order to be confirmed. It's a subtle minuet, and it will be always a matter of great interest as to how we proceed. I do not intend to ask you whether you were overruled Roe versus Wade. I will ask you whether you think the Constitution has a right of privacy, and I will ask questions about precedents as they bear on Roe versus Wade. I'm very much concerned about what I conceive to be an imbalance in the separation of powers between the Congress and the court. I'm concerned about what I bluntly say is the denigration by the court of congressional authority. When the Supreme Court of the United States struck down a portion of the legislation to protect women against violence, the court did so because of our, quote, method of reasoning, close quote. And the dissent noted that that had carried the implication of judicial competence, and the inverse of that is congressional incompetence. And after 25 years in this body and on fact-finding, and there was an extensive record made in the case in the legislation to protect women against violence, the court simply disregarded it. And then the issue of states' rights, the Supreme Court of the United States has elevated states' rights, but in a context that it's impossible to figure out what the law is. The Americans for Disabilities Act had a very extensive record. But when the case came up in 2001, Garrett, a woman who had breast cancer, the Supreme Court said that the section of the act was unconstitutional. 4 years later, in Lane versus Tennessee, you had a paraplegia crawling up the steps, access to a courtroom. The court said that that was constitutional, again 5-4, on what really turned out to be inexplicable decisions. You have a very extensive paper trail, and there will obviously be questions on that subject, and we'll be concerned about what your views are today, contrasted with what your views may have been in the future. Phyllis Schlafly, the president of the Eagles Forum, said that they were smart alecky comments by a bachelor who didn't have a whole lot of experience. So she's putting on an understandable gloss on that subject, but I know that will be a matter of considerable interest. In one of your early memoranda, you came forward with an intriguing thought. One of many in those early memorandas is your conceptualization power was evident. The justices ought to be limited to a 15-year term. And with that idea in play, if time permits, it's something I'd like to explore. Voluntary action on the part of a justice, or perhaps the president could make that a condition. Between now and the year 2040, or in the intervening years, technology will present many, many novel issues. And there again, if time permits, I'd like to explore that. I'm down to 10 seconds, and I intend to stop precisely on time, and this committee has a record for maintaining that time. That's it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I now yield to my distinguished colleagues.
On this first day of hearings, we're going to hear opening statements from each of the senators. After Chairman Specter, we turn now to Patrick Leahy of Vermont, Democrat, the ranking Democrat on this committee.
A few days ago, William Rehnquist passed away. He had 33 years of service on the Supreme Court. Now, last week, many of us paid our respects for his service to the monumental building across the street, in which he devoted himself to protecting the independence of the federal judiciary. I know, Judge Roberts, that was a particularly difficult time for you because of your close relationship with him. But I thought of the facade of that court with its marble from Vermont, and I think of how much our state served as a refuge for the Chief Justice, especially in the summer months. Today, the devastation and despair facing millions of our fellow Americans in the Gulf region is a tragic reminder of why we have a federal government, why it is critical that our government be responsive. We need the federal government for our protection and security, cast a lifeline to those in distress, to mobilize vital resources beyond the ability of any state or local government, and all of this for the common good. The full dimensions of the disaster not yet known. Bodies of loved ones need to be recovered. Families need to be reunited. The survivors need to be assisted. Long-term health risks and environmental damage have to be assessed. But if anyone needed a reminder of the need and role of a government, the last few days have provided it. If anyone needed a reminder of the growing poverty and despair among too many Americans, we now have it. And if anyone needed a reminder of the racial divide that remains in our nation, no one can now doubt we still have miles to go. I believe that the American people still want and expect and demand their government to help ensure justice and equal opportunity for all, and especially for those who, through no fault of their own, were born into poverty. The American people deserve a government as good as they are, with a heart as big as theirs. We are all Americans. And all Americans should have the opportunity to earn a fair share of the bounty and blessings that America has. And, Judge, we've been given a great Constitution. As you know as well as anybody here, it begins, "We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. It's a framework for our government, foundation of all our rights and liberties." In fact, Vermont joined the Union the same year the Bill of Rights was ratified. Those of us from the Green Mountain State, the nation's 14th state, we've historically been very protective of our fundamental rights and liberties. Many feel that we didn't join the Union until we were sure the Bill of Rights was going to go through. We understand the importance of the Constitution and Bill of Rights. In these hearings, we're going to be discussing constitutional issues that may seem legalistic, but they're vital issues. They affect every one of us every day. When we discuss the Constitution's Commerce Clause or spending power, for example, we're asking about congressional authority to pass laws to ensure clean air and water and children's and seniors' health and safe food, drugs, safe workplaces, even wetland protection levees that should protect our communities from natural disasters. Our constitutional values remain constant. We want to realize the American promise of fairness and equality and justice. Constitution, we the people. When the Constitution was written, though, we the people did not include Native Americans or African-American slaves, but only free people. It took more than 40 years in a civil war before the Constitution was amended to include all citizens, all persons born and naturalized in the United States. Even then, half of the people didn't have one of democracy's defining rights. Women were not yet guaranteed the right to vote. That didn't happen until 1920. And decades later, still, it took an historic constitutional ruling, a unanimous ruling by the United States Supreme Court in the case of Brown versus Board of Education, and then landmark legislation by the federal government for America to begin to provide a measure of equality to many who were held back for so long because, and only because, of the color of their skin. I've long been a proponent of First Amendment freedoms and open government, because the public's right to know what our government is doing promotes accountability. Federal judges aren't elected. You know, they serve for life if they're confirmed. The people never have the opportunity for effective oversight of their work. The judiciary is the most isolated branch of our government from public accountability. So this is the only opportunity to examine what kind of justice John Roberts will dispense if promoted to the Supreme Court, the direction he'd lead the federal judiciary. This hearing is the only chance that we the people, have to hear from and reflect on the suitability of the nominee to be a final arbiter of the meaning of the Constitution. An open and honest public conversation with the nominee in these hearing rooms is an important part of this process. This hearing is about the fundamental rights of all Americans, and you're the first nominee of the 21st century. If you're confirmed, you serve not just for the remaining 3 years of the Bush administration, but you could serve through the administrations of the next 7 or 8 presidents. Judge Roberts would be deciding matters that affect not only all Americans today, but also our children and our grandchildren. In one of these hearings nearly 20 years ago, I noted how critical it is for the Senate to engage in a public exploration of the judicial philosophy of Supreme Court nominees. I said, there can hardly be an issue closer to the heart of the Senate's role than a full and public exposition of the nominee's approach to the Constitution and to the role of the courts in discerning and enforcing its commands. That's what I mean by judicial philosophy. And the truth has not changed. What's more difficult to see, though, is the arc of the law in the years ahead as justices will vote on which cases to accept and then how to decide them. Ours is a government of laws. When we're faced with a vacancy on the Supreme Court, we're reminded that it's our fellow citizens, 9 of our 280 million Americans, who interpret and apply those laws. And the balance of the direction of the Supreme Court now at issue with 2 vacancies, both Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Chief among emerging concerns are whether the Supreme Court will continue its recent efforts to restrict the authority of Congress to pass legislation to protect the people's interests in the environment, in safety, in civil rights, and whether the Supreme Court will effectively check the greatly enhanced presidential power that's been amassed in the last few years. In other words, Judge, whether you be the protector of the rights of all Americans, not just Republicans, not just Democrats, not just independents, but all Americans, and whether you can serve as a check and balance that all Americans expect. Now, the light of the nominations process is intense. It's intense because it's the only time that light's going to shine. But the afterglow lasts for the rest of a justice's career. We, the people, have just this one chance to inquire whether this person should be entrusted with the privilege and responsibility of interpreting our Constitution and dispensing justice from the nation's highest court. 280 million Americans. President made his choice. Now there's only 100 Americans standing in the shoes of all other Americans. And on behalf of the American people, it's the job of the 100 of us in the Senate to do all we can to make sure we get it right. Mr. Chairman, there's time left over, but I've said all I intend to say.
Thank you very much.
On this first day of the confirmation hearings for John Roberts, senators of the Judiciary Committee are reading opening statements. Next is the longtime chairman of this committee. That will be Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah.
Thoughts and prayers are with the family of Chief Justice William Rehnquist. He concluded his life on earth just the way he lived it, independently and with dignity. And I'm glad that his family was with him when he passed away. He was a good man and a great judge. Judge Roberts, I know that you and Chief Justice Rehnquist remained close friends. He would have been proud to have a former clerk serve with him as a colleague on the court, and now you've been nominated to succeed him as Chief Justice. When President Bush nominated you 2 years ago to your current post on the U.S. Court of Appeals, you had two hearings before this committee and additionally answered approximately 100 written questions from various senators. The American Bar Association twice unanimously gave you its highest well-qualified rating. That process covered a lot of ground, including many of the same issues which are sure to be raised here. You acquitted yourself so well that the Senate confirmed you without dissent. Do not be surprised now, however, if it seems like none of that scrutiny and evaluation had ever happened. Let me mention one example relating to my home state of Utah to show how the confirmation process has changed. President Warren G. Harding nominated former Utah Senator George Sutherland to the Supreme Court on September 5, 1922. That same day, the Judiciary Committee chairman went straight to the Senate floor and, after a few remarks, made a motion to confirm the nomination. The Senate promptly and unanimously agreed. There was no inquisition, no fishing expedition, no scurrilous and false attack ads. The judicial selection process, of course, has changed because what some political forces want judges to do has changed from what America's founders established. America's founders believed that separating the branches of government, with the legislatures making the law and the judiciary interpreting and applying the law, is the linchpin of limited government and liberty. James Madison said that no political truth has greater intrinsic value. Quoting the philosopher Montesquieu, Alexander Hamilton wrote in The Federalist No. 78 that, quote, "There is no liberty if the power of judging be not separated from the legislative and executive powers," unquote. Well, times have changed. Today, some see the separation of powers not as a condition for liberty, but as an obstacle to their own political agenda. When they lose in the legislature, they want the judiciary to give them another bite at the political apple. Politicizing the judiciary leads to politicizing judicial selection. The confirmation process has sometimes been, it seems to me, unbecoming of the Senate and disrespectful of nominees. I applaud President Bush for resisting this trend and for nominating qualified men and women who, as judges, will not legislate from the bench, and you're a perfect example of that. The conviction that judges interpret and apply but do not make the law helps us sort out the information we need, the questions we ask, the standards we apply, and the decisions we make. With that in mind, I believe that there are three facts that should guide us in this hearing. First, what judges do limits what judicial nominees may discuss. Judges must be impartial and independent. Their very oath of office requires impartiality, and the canons of judicial ethics prohibit judges and judicial nominees from making commitments regarding issues that may come before them. I will be the first to admit that senators want answers to a great many questions. But I also have to admit that a senator's desire to know something is not the only consideration on the table. Some have said that nominees who do not spill their guts about whatever a senator wants to know are hiding something from the American people. Some compare a nominee's refusal to violate his judicial oath or abandon judicial ethics to taking the Fifth Amendment. These might be catchy sound bites, but they are patently false. That notion misleads the American people about what judges do and slanders good and honorable nominees who want to be both responsive to senators and protect their impartiality and independence. Nominees may not be able to answer questions that seek hints, forecasts, or previews about how they would rule on particular issues. Some senators consult with law professors to ask these questions a dozen different ways, but we all know that is what they seek. In 1993, President Clinton's Supreme Court nominee, Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg, explained better than I can why nominees cannot answer such questions no matter how they're framed. She said, quote, "A judge sworn to decide impartially can offer no forecasts, no hints, for that would show not only disregard for the specifics of the particular case, it would display disdain for the entire judicial process," unquote. Nominees may not be able to answer questions asking them to opine or speculate about hypotheticals outside of an actual case with concrete issues and real facts. Since 1792, as long as the judiciary itself has existed, the Supreme Court has held that judges do not have the authority to render such advisory opinions. We should not be surprised, then, when nominees decline to provide what judges themselves may not provide. So the first fact that should guide us here is that no matter how badly senators want to know things, judicial nominees are limited in what they may discuss. That limitation is real, and it comes from the very nature of what judges do. The second fact is that nominees themselves must determine where to draw the line. Judges, not senators, take the oath of judicial office. Judges, not senators, are bound by the canons of judicial ethics. Judge Roberts will be a federal judge for many years to come. This process will only determine which courtroom he will occupy. He must determine how best to honor his judicial obligations. Different nominees may draw this line a little differently, but they draw the same kind of line protecting their judicial impartiality and independence. Justice Stephen Breyer drew that line in 1994. As he put it, clients and lawyers must understand that judges are really open-minded. Justice Anthony Kennedy drew that line in 1987. He said that the public expects that a judge will be confirmed because of his temperament and character, not his position on the issues. Recently, one of our colleagues on this committee dismissed as a myth the idea that Justice Ginsburg refused to discuss things related to how she would rule. Anyone watching C-SPAN's recent replays of Justice Ginsburg's hearing knows that this is not a myth. It is a reality. I was on this committee in 1993. Justice Ginsburg was not telling mythological tales when she refused nearly 60 times to answer questions, including mine, that she believed would violate what she said was her rule of, quote, "no hints, no forecasts, no previews," unquote. Those were her words, not mine. Justice Ginsburg did what every Supreme Court nominee has done. She drew the line she believed was necessary to protect her impartiality and independence. Finally, the third fact that should guide us is that the Senate traditionally has respected the nominee's judgment about where to draw the line. In response to some of my questions, Justice Ginsburg said, quote, "I must draw the line at that point and hope you will respect what I have tried to tell you," unquote. Did I wish she had drawn the line differently? Of course, but I respected her decision. This is the historical standard. In 1967, our colleague, Senator Kennedy, a former chairman of this committee, made the same point at a press conference supporting the Supreme Court nomination of Thurgood Marshall. Senator Kennedy said, quote, "We have to respect that any nominee to the Supreme Court would have to defer any comments on any matters which are either before the court or very likely to appear before the court. This has been a procedure which has been followed in the past and is one which I think is based upon sound legal precedent." Justice Marshall drew his line, yet we confirmed him by a vote of 69-11. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor drew her line, yet we confirmed her by a vote of 99-0. Justice Kennedy drew his line, yet we confirmed him by a vote of 97-0. Justice Ginsburg drew her line, yet we confirmed her by a vote of 96-3. Justice Breyer do his line, yet we confirmed him by a vote of 87-9. And we must use a judicial rather than a political standard to evaluate Judge Roberts' fitness for the Supreme Court. That standard must be based upon the fundamental principle that judges interpret and apply, but do not make the law. Judge Roberts, as every Supreme Court nominee has done in the past, you must decide how best to honor your commitment to judicial impartiality and independence. You must decide when that obligation is more important than what senators, including this one, might want to know. As the Senate has done in the past, I believe we should honor your decision and make our own. Now, Judge Roberts, you have a tremendously complex and important and honorable record. From law school through the various positions in government that you held to the judge on the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia to now, we have a great deal of respect for you. We expect you to make a great justice, and I just want to congratulate you on your nomination.
Thank you very much, Senator Hatch. I know
John Roberts listening
Senator Warner
attentively,
is with us, one of the
as members of the Senate Judiciary Committee issue statements on this first day of confirmation hearings on his nomination to be Chief Justice of the United States. And next will be another former chairman of this committee. That's Democrat Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts.
Join in welcoming you and your family to this committee and to this famous room, the site of so many historic hearings. Today, our nation's flags are at half-mast to honor the memory of Chief Justice Rehnquist and his deep dedication to his beloved Supreme Court. And we know that Judge Roberts was especially close to him, and our thoughts and prayers go to the Rehnquist family and all who knew him. As we are all aware, the Senate's actions on this nomination is profoundly important. It's a defining opportunity to consider the values that make our nation strong and just and how to implement them more effectively, especially the guiding principle of more than two centuries of our history that we are all created equal. Our commitment to this founding principle is especially relevant today. Americans are united as rarely before in compassion and generosity for our fellow citizens whose lives have been devastated by Hurricane Katrina. That massive tragedy also taught us another lesson. The powerful winds and floodwaters of Katrina tore away the mask that has hidden from public view the many Americans who are left out and left behind. As one nation under God, we cannot continue to ignore the injustice, the inequality, and the gross disparities that exist in our society. Across the years, we have experienced times of great turmoil and great triumph as each succeeding generation struggled to live up to our founding principle and give it meaning for everyone. Americans have shed blood, campaigned, and marched. They have worked in countless quiet ways as well to see that every one of our citizens is part of our democracy and has an equal opportunity for a good education, a good job, and a good life. Today, grandparents who were denied the right to vote expect their grandsons and granddaughters to be able to cast a ballot without discrimination or intimidation. And our society is better because of that progress. Today, fathers and mothers expect their daughters to have the same opportunities as their sons to attend college, play sports, earn fair pay. And our society is better because of that progress. Today, parents expect their disabled children to live in hope, to receive an education that draws out their talent, enables them to reach for their dreams like all other Americans. And our society is better because of that progress. Too many have sacrificed too much, worked too hard, come too far to turn back the clock on that progress. Americans today expect their elected representatives to carry on the great unfinished business of making America the land of opportunity for all. And we expect our courts to defend our progress as their constitutional responsibility. The challenge today is especially difficult because of the vast global economic changes and major new threats to our national security, and we need the ingenuity and innovation and commitment of every American. Our military leaders are the first to say that highly qualified, racially diverse armed forces are essential to defend our country and the cause of freedom at home and abroad. Every citizen counts, and we must continue to remove barriers that hold back millions of our people. And we must draw strength from our diversity as we compete in a new world of promise and peril. So the central issue before us in these hearings is whether the Supreme Court will preserve the gains of the past and protect the rights that are indispensable to a modern, more competitive, more equal America. Commitment to equality for all is not only a matter of fairness and conscience, it's also our path to sustain national strength and purpose. We also are a government of the people in which citizens have a strong voice in the great issues that shape our lives. Our systems of checks and balances was drawn up in full awareness of the principle that absolute power corrupts absolutely, and was designed to make sure that no branch of government becomes so powerful that it can avoid accountability. The people have a right to know that their government is promoting their interests, not the special interests, when it comes to the price of gasoline and the safety of prescription drugs, the air we breathe, and the water we drink, and the food and other products we buy. The people have a right to keep government from intruding into their private lives and most personal decisions. But the tragedy of Katrina shows in the starkest terms why every American needs an effective national government that will step in to meet urgent needs that individual states and communities cannot meet on their own. Above all, the people and their Congress must have a voice in decisions that determine the safety of our country and the integrity of our individual rights. We expect Supreme Court justices to uphold those rights and the rule of times in both war and peace. All this and more will be before the Supreme Court in the years ahead. And its judgments will affect the direction and character of our country for generations to come. Judge Roberts, you are an intelligent, well-educated, and serious man. You have vast legal experience, and you're considered to be one of the finest legal advocates in America. These qualities are surely important qualifications for a potential Supreme Court justice, but they do not end the inquiry of our responsibility. This committee and the full Senate must also determine whether you have demonstrated a commitment to the constitutional principles that have been so vital in advancing fairness, decency, and equal opportunity in our society. We have only one chance to get it right, and a solemn obligation to do so. If you confirm, you could serve in the court for a generation or more, and the decisions you make as a justice will have a direct impact on the lives of our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren. Because of this special importance of an appointment like yours, the founders called for a shared power between the President and the Senate. The Senate was not intended to be a rubber stamp for a President's nominees to the Supreme Court. And, as George Washington himself found out, it has not been. Judges are appointed by and with the advice and consent of the Senate. And it is our duty to ask questions on great issues that matter to the American people and speak for them. Judge Roberts, I hope you will respond fully and candidly to such questions, not just to earn our approval, but to prove to the American people that you have earned the right to a lifetime appointment to the highest court in the land. Unfortunately, Mr. Chairman, there are real and serious reasons to be deeply concerned about Judge Roberts' records. Many of his past statements and writings raise questions about his commitment to equal opportunity and to the bipartisan remedies we've adopted in the past. This hearing is John Roberts' job interview with the American people. He will have a fair chance to express his values, state his views, and defend his record. The burden on him is especially heavy because the administration, at least so far, has chosen not to allow the Senate to have access to his full record. We can only wonder what they don't want us to know. In particular, we need to know his views on civil rights, voting rights, and the right to privacy, especially the removal of existing barriers to full and fair lives for women, minorities, and the disabled. From the start, America was summoned to be a shining city on a hill. But each generation must keep building that city. Even in this new century, some Americans are still denied a voice at the ballot box because of their color, denied a promotion because of their gender, denied a job because of their age, denied hope because they are gay, or denied an appropriate education because they are disabled. Long-established rights to privacy are under heavy siege. We need a Chief Justice who believes in the promise of America and the guarantees of our Constitution, a person who will enter that majestic building near here and genuinely believe the four inspiring words inscribed in marble above the entrance, equal justice under law. I look forward to hearing from Judge Roberts about whether, if he joins the Supreme Court, he will uphold the progress we have made and will guarantee that all Americans have their rightful place in the nation's future.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Opening statements from senators, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee on this first day of the confirmation hearings for Judge John Roberts to be Chief Justice of the United States. Next is Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa.
To replace a mentor of yours, Chief Justice Rehnquist, you obviously have a tough act to follow. And that's because Chief Justice Rehnquist was a great Supreme Court justice. He believed in strict application of the law and the Constitution and was a consistent voice for judicial restraint. And we will all miss his leadership. Judge Roberts, we had a good personal meeting in my office a little over a month ago. And based on our discussions and what I've reviewed, you appear to be extremely well qualified. At our meeting, I was encouraged by your respect for the limited role of the courts as an institution in our democratic society, and I look forward to asking more questions about your record and qualifications as well as your judicial approach. I also look forward to asking you about what you think are priorities for the federal judiciary as you now lead that branch. Of course, as we reflect on the enormous buildup to this day and the packed hearing room filled with media lights and cameras, it's worth recalling the fact that judicial nominees never appeared before the Senate until 1925. Ever since then, for the most part, the hearings were not public spectacles. In 1962, for example, when Byron White was nominated to the Supreme Court by President Kennedy, the hearing before the Judiciary Committee lasted all of 15 minutes and 8 questions. It seems to me that the Senate sure got it right with Justice White, and Justice White went on to serve then for a generation. Of course, all this was before we had televised hearings, which has encouraged ratcheting up the rhetoric to play to various constituencies. Furthermore, Judge Roberts, you are the first nominee of the Internet age, with millions of eyes scrutinizing thousands of downloading pages of writing, not to mention the hundreds of website blogs characterizing the documents that have been produced in an accurate or more likely inaccurate way, and opining on every record that you've been involved with and doing it by the minute. So to some extent, there is no turning back from what we've created here, and you just happen to be the latest victim of such scrutiny. During the Ginsburg nomination, Senator Biden, then chairman of the Judiciary Committee, urged that we not treat these hearings, in Senator Biden's words, as make-or-break trials of dramatic importance. And I sure agree with what he said then. Rather, the hearing provides us a unique opportunity for us to ensure that each person appointed to the federal bench will be a true judge and not some sort of super legislator. The court should not be made up of seats designated conservative, liberal, moderate. Rather, we have responsibilities to fill the federal bench with individuals who will faithfully interpret the laws and the Constitution, individuals who will withhold any personal, political, or ideological tendencies from their decision-making process. And this is even more important than when we're confirming you now to the Supreme Court as opposed to when we confirmed you to the Circuit Court. There are a number of qualities that I look for in a Supreme Court nominee. I believe that the nominee should be someone who knows he or she is not appointed to impose his or her views of what's right or wrong. As Chief Justice Marshall said over 200 years ago, the duty of the judge is to say what the law is, not what it ought to be. Moreover, the nominee should be someone who not only understands, but truly respects the equal roles and responsibilities of the different branches of government and the role of our states in the federal system. If we confirm a nominee who is all of this, none of us on the political right or the political left will be disappointed, because it will mean in the end that the people, through their elected representatives, will be in charge. On the other hand, if we confirm individuals who are bent on assigning to themselves the power to fix society's problems as they see fit, a bare majority of these 9 unelected and unaccountable men and women will usurp the power of the people, hijacking democracy to serve their own political prejudices. We do not want to go down that road, and we should not go down that road. Why is it then so important to have Supreme Court justices practice judicial restraint? Because that means the policy choices of the democratically elected branches of government will only be overturned if and when there is a clear warrant to do so in the Constitution itself. We want Supreme Court justices to exercise judicial restraint so that cases will be decided solely on the law and the principles set forth in the Constitution, and not upon an individual justice's personal philosophical views or preferences. Felix Frankfurter identified this as the highest example of judicial duty. A fundamental principle of our country is that the majority has the legitimate right to govern. This approach hardly means that the courts are less energetic in protecting individual rights, but the words of the Constitution constrain judges every bit as much as they control legislators, executives, and our citizens. Otherwise, we're no longer a nation of law, but a nation of politicians dressed in judges' robes. During my tenure in the Senate, I participated in a number of these Supreme Court nomination hearings, and I believe it's 9 to date. I'm hopeful that we will see a dignified confirmation process that will not degenerate into what we saw during the Bork and Thomas hearings. Rather, we need to see the same level of civility as we saw during the O'Connor, Ginsburg's, and Breyer hearings. Moreover, I'm hoping that we won't see a badgering of a nominee about how he'll rule on specific cases and possible issues that will or may come before the court. That has been the practice, as you know, in the past. And let me remind my colleagues that Justices Ginsburg and Breyer refused to answer questions on how they would rule on cases during the confirmation hearings. The fact is that no senator has the right to insist on his or her own issue-by-issue philosophy or seek commitments from nominees on specific litmus test questions likely to come before that court. To do so is to give in to the liberal interest groups that only want judges who will do their political bidding from the bench, regardless of what is required by the law and the Constitution. The result is, then, loss of independence for the Supreme Court and a lessening of our government's checks and balances. Some have suggested that since you've been nominated now to be Chief Justice, you deserve even more scrutiny than before when you were just nominated for Associate. Some are saying that we should prolong the hearings and turn over even more stones than we've already turned over thus far. Well, the Chief Justice has been described as first among equals. The plain truth is that there really isn't anything substantively different in your role, and your vote will count just the same as other justices of the court. So my own questioning and analysis of your qualifications will not really be much different from your previous appointment. But it is true that the Chief Justice has additional duties as the head of the federal judiciary. The Chief Justice has to be someone who has a good management style, who can run the trains on time, and who can foster collegiality in the court. So, Judge Robert, I think that since you've appeared before the court 39 times to argue cases on appeal, and that the current justices know and respect you, that bodes very well in terms of your smoothly transitioning into the court, into the new role now of Chief Justice. I congratulate you.
Thank you very much.
The Senate Judiciary Committee is considering the nomination of John Roberts to be Chief Justice of the United States. Next, we'll hear from another former chairman of this committee, Democrat Joseph Biden of Delaware.
Never heard of or seen a federal judge who wasn't independent. It's amazing what that life tenure does. So I don't think you have any worry, Judge, about having to cash in your independence. It's never occurred in my memory or in my study. And, Judge, I want to point out to my friends that it is true judges didn't come before the committee in the past, but it used to be required in the past you needed unanimous consent of the entire Senate to get before the Senate. So, you know, there's some good things and some bad things that have changed. Judge, as you know, there's a genuine intellectual debate going on in our country today over whether the Constitution is going to continue to expand the protections of the right to privacy, continue to empower the federal government to protect the powerless. And it's a big debate. All you got to do is turn on any website, American Enterprise Institute, left, right, center. It's a gigantic debate. Hadn't occurred, as you and I both know and my colleagues know, in the last 70 years. It has not been this contentious. Not just the politics, but the debate, the intellectual debate. For 70 years, there's been a consensus, Judge, on our Supreme Court on these issues of privacy and protecting the powerless. And this consensus has been fully embraced, in my view, by the American people. But there are those who strongly disagree with the consensus, as is their right, and they seek to unravel the consensus. And, Judge, you are in the unenviable position, as we talked about in my office, of being right in the middle of this fundamentally important debate. And quite frankly, Judge, we need to know on which side of that divide you stand. For whoever replaces Justice Rehnquist, as well as Justice O'Connor, will play a pivotal role in this debate. And for tens of millions of the American people, this is no academic exercise. For the position you will take in this debate will affect their lives in very real and personal ways for at least, God willing, the next 3 decades. And there is nothing they can do about it after this moment. Judge, I believe in a Constitution, as our Supreme Court's first great chief has been mentioned here today, Justice Marshall, said in 1819, and I quote, "A Constitution intended to endure for ages to come and consequently to be adapted to the various crises of human affairs." That's the Constitution I believe in. That's the way, and I think we should look at the Constitution. At its core, the Constitution envisions ever-increasing protections for human liberty and dignity for all its citizens, and a national government empowered to deal with these unanticipated crises. Judge, herein lies, in my view, the crux of the intellectual debate I referred to at the outset. whether we will have an ever-increasing protection for human dignity and human liberty, or whether those protections will be diminished, as suggested by many in their reading of the Constitution that says there are no unenumerated rights. There is a very narrow reading of the Constitution. In 1925, the Constitution preserved the rights of parents to determine how to educate their kids, striking down a law that required children to attend public school. In 1965, the Constitution told the state to get out of married couples' bedrooms by striking down a state law prohibiting married couples from using contraceptives. In 1967, the Constitution defended the right of a black woman to marry a white man. In 1977, the Constitution stopped a city from making it a crime for a grandmother to live with her grandchildren. And fortunately, even when the Supreme Court at first took the Constitution away from the promise of hope of our Constitution's ennobling phrases, in the end, it has kept the faith. In 1873, for example, the court said states could forbid women from being lawyers. It took 100 years to undo this terrible mistake, but the court eventually got it right. In 1896, the Supreme Court said separate but equal was unlawful. It took 58 years for the Supreme Court to outlaw racial segregation, throwing the doctrine into the dustbin of history, but it got it right. In the early 1900s, the court rendered the federal government powerless to outlaw child labor, to protect workers. It took until 1937 for the Supreme Court to see the error of its ways, but it finally got it right. In every step, we've had to struggle against those who saw the Constitution as frozen in time, Judge. But time and again, we've overcome, and the Constitution has remained relevant and dynamic, thanks to the proper interpretation, in my view, of the ennobling phrases purposely placed in what I refer to as our civic Bible, the Constitution. And once again, when it should be even more obvious to all Americans, we need increased protections for liberty. As we look around the world and we see thousands of people persecuted because of their faith, women unable to show their faces in public, children maimed and killed for no other reason than they were born in the wrong tribe. And once again, when it should be obvious, we need a more energetic national government to deal with the challenges of the new millennium. Terrorism, the spread of weapons of mass destruction, pandemic disease, religious intolerance. Once again, our journey of progress is under attack and is coming from, in my view, the right. There are judges, scholars, and opinion leaders who belong to this group of people